Hold on to your butts, it's time for a new episode of Destroy All Culture, a sonic death ray from Dimension X that sounds exactly like a weekly podcast hosted by Adam P. Nave and Aiden Morgan. Exposure to Destroy All Culture is 100% fatal, so we put it on the internet. Now listen and die! Lethal effects may take up to 75 years. And here we are with Destroy All Culture, episode 111, with Aiden Morgan and me, Adam P. Nave.
Ooh, babadoo, babadoo.
I actually did it this time. I'm kind of proud of myself.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Mm.
It's kind of sad that I'm proud of that, but you know.
We take pride in the things that we accomplish. Although, actually, I think you saying it properly would be with me, Adam P. Nave, and Aiden Morgan, and then I say hello.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, no, I did it. I did it the old wrong way. Okay, never mind.
Yes. So
I didn't do it right yet again.
Yes, so your pride was entirely misplaced, but I...
Oh, God damn it.
Savor that brief sense of accomplishment.
I'll save it up for later. Damn it. Okay, let's just keep going. Oh, God. So, Killjoys. Killjoys happened this week.
Yes, and they're still not killing the Joy.
Mm. Very true. This episode featured what might be one of my favorite moments in the show, weirdly.
Tell me.
Taking off his earrings.
Ooh, he's taking off his earrings.
Like, I don't know if that's a thing where you're from. But, like, it's like taking off your rings or taking off, like, your earrings means you're about to, like, seriously kick someone's ass. Hmm. Like, that's, like, your last chance to back away.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And I just laughed so hard that they did it.
That's Pri's version of the gloves are coming off. Like, the earrings are coming.
It's a standard thing, you know. It's
yeah.
Although I did kind of question the, you know, help me find the earrings. Because I'm like, they just put them in a pocket. What's up?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm assuming that in the fight, they got knocked around.
It just felt like, what would you do, drop on the floor? You're better than that. Come on. I know, it's a weird thing to get hung up on, but I just love Torrin's joy of, like, I'll wait for this.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's my favorite thing is that you see absolutely none of the fight. I mean, it's all, like, Pri is sufficiently a badass that, like... It all has to take place in your head, like the terrible things that he's doing to these randos.
Well, I mean, because you know, back even before we knew, like, well, we already actually kind of knew the warlord thing, but when he first meets Gavin, Garrett rather, and he stabs him in the hand, and he's like, you know, I've done worse to get this bar.
Right.
And it's just like they've been building this, like, Pri is this badass who just doesn't bother for years now.
Right. Oh, that was great. Yeah, there is a lot. I mean, every time I watch a Killjoys episode, I think, this is one of my favorites.
Right.
Because it's so heavily serialized, it's like they all blend together into one big, long favorite episode for me.
Oh, yeah. No, totally. Extra sassy Lucy.
Extra relationships keep... No, sorry. Surprises keep our relationship spicy.
Remind me to adjust your sats filters.
Yeah, no, I think Tams McDonough got some great lines, and I always kind of miss it when Lucy and Johnny aren't sort of back and forthing.
Right.
So this was fantastic to hear them sort of like do their back and forth bits.
Yeah, I gotta say I did not expect the whole like, I mean I kind of did because it felt like they were obviously building toward it. But at the same time, the, like, 250 years ago, here's, like, Aniwa's mother.
Oh, yeah.
And then here she is now. I was just like, what? Okay, this is one of those shows where, yeah, they're just going to do it. They're just going to do it.
Exactly. I mean, I knew it. Like, as soon as, like, I thought to myself,
sure.
She's going to show up in some way, and then then Dutch walks into the room with the cryopod, and I'm like, okay.
Right.
She's going
like,
to come face
it was still trying to figure out how. You know what I mean?
And I don't think she actually comes out and says, "Yeah, I'm your granddaughter of sorts."
No,
they just kind of leave it hanging,
that, like their family.
Right? Yeah, that's when she says, "Literally, yeah, you're."
Well, because it's
family.
Not easy to explain.
I know. Exactly. Imagine that it's a sheer amount of exposition that will be required in that universe for anybody to explain who they are.
Right. I mean, and again, like, she's referred to Neil as her, like, sister mother because... Clyde is her father, too. It's such a weird, like, just don't even worry about it anymore. Just...
Yeah, exactly. It's positively the family tree is just downright hillbilly at this point.
Right. Yeah. But the whole, like, we do have that final confirmation too. Cause, like, she was always like, she's a princess. She was always told this by Klein, but it was never quite clear in the fact that there was a tenth family.
Right. Yes. Yes, I found that fascinating. Yeah, I like the extra bit of backstory we got on Klein. It's funny because I was in my notes for the episode. After that scene where Yelena, the crushy queen, is sort of interacting with Klein, I wrote, and I was very mistaken, I wrote that it was interesting to see Klein not as this sort of like almost supernatural, sort of ambiguously evil character, but as just a person. But
yeah.
As you realize, he's actually, by this point, he's already not a person.
Right, but he's acting like he used to way more, or trying to.
Right. Yeah. Or he's not on top of the situation in the way that, or at least it appears at first that he usually is.
Right.
And I just love the bit when she says it was just an echo, and he said, "Well, that echo is more than most people feel." And I thought that line, I mean, said quite a bit about Killjoys. It's really about people sort of just chasing echoes around.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting if you look back. With Klein, who, you know, always kind of early on, treats Dutch as not quite a thing, but, like, at a remove.
Yeah.
And you're not sure later on, if that makes sense, as a sentence. If it's because of the Hohenizing or something else, but whenever you see him with Anila, well, either of them, I guess, now... You do get that sense of, like, this is his weak spot, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
This is the thing that humanizes him, you know, is his family, is the people he loves. And that he keeps Dutch at a remove because he doesn't know what she is. And because he's afraid of her, essentially.
Mm.
And what she could mean, because if the lady finds out, then...
Right.
You know, and of course he's also mourning the loss of everyone else. Like, and so the remove makes sense because she is everything that he's lost, all wrapped up.
Yes, yes.
In a second chance, and that's, oh god, if I get too close and I screw this one up, I couldn't take it, sort of thing.
Right.
So yeah, you look back at Klein, it's like, and all of his actions make perfect sense straight through, which shouldn't be something that we're like, yay, but it is really hard when you're building mythology kind of after the fact. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean they've done it well enough that you could imagine them sitting down before the first season and actually breaking out the entire story and the entire mythology of Killjoys.
Right.
But I mean, that really, it never really works like that. I mean,
no, of course not, because you'd be dumb to, like, just writing doesn't work like that.
Exactly. But
it's what Grant Morrison said, right? Like, years ago, he was talking about someone who's like, you know, all of his plots feel like they were just all worked out so carefully. And he's like, no, he leaves threads on the floor when he does stuff. And then the trick is to, you know, figure out all the threads that you've left and pull. And if you pull, like, all those threads together at the end, it looks like you meant it all along, when really it's that kind of instinct that you get as a storyteller for which threads to leave that might be useful later and might not. Like, some of them you can just leave.
Yeah.
But if you leave five threads and you pull three together, it looks like you're magic.
Yes. Which is something of a... I mean, it's such a pleasure to see it happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm not discounting it anyway, because again, it's really hard to do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's funny when people imagine that writing is one kind of craft, but it's a different kind of craft. It's no less difficult, but it's just a little different than what people who are consuming the entertainment think.
Right. I mean, and again, like, even me, like, I tend to be very heavily structured when I work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tend to rely on a lot of structure to kind of keep me on the path and do all this. Like, I still, obviously, like, leave a lot of room that maybe I don't talk about when I talk about, like, that 45 things and all this. Like, you know, because we've had that talk before, right?
Right.
And, you know, when I say, like, oh, I do 45 things, and then that makes a novel, and it sounds like, oh, I just have everything worked out. It's like, you gotta understand that, like, the 45 things will be things like looking at the novel I'm working on now, because I just have that the beat pass up. There's one of them that's just, like, fight to this place. Like, they have to get to this place, and this is the chapter they fight through. I don't know what happens.
Right.
You know, I don't know how they... I just... This is my marker for... This is kind of... The overall action, like, this is where they have to get to this place somehow, but it won't be easy. And
right.
But in the moment, you know, I get to invent what that is, and then I rework everything forward every time, because you need that room to kind of invent and adjust and have a better idea. And actually, it just happened in, like, the middle of this chapter, so they're like, wait a minute, I could put this whole thing here. And I'm like, didn't I have that marked for later? And I looked, I was like, no, I actually didn't have that hard marked, because I was like... I need to fit this bit in, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't know where it goes. But I'll feel it, which I did. Because this is where this belongs now. Like, this is the moment.
Right.
And just go with it. But it'll feel very planned out.
Gotcha. Yeah,
like, that is the trick.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of like playing, like, darts, but you put the target up after you throw the dart when no one's looking.
Right. Yeah, there's a certain level of intuition that realistically isn't intuition, it's experience.
Yes.
That you just learn to trust yourself. You learn to trust your ability and your process, and to not overthink everything, which is your first move, because be it a long-form TV show or a novel or anything, it's a long road, right? Like,
right.
You have to... learn to trust that it's like people who occasionally, like, you hear, like, people who, you know, they drive home, like, you know, from work every day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they have, like, three or four different routes, and maybe they'll take a new one or whatever, but unless something goes really weird, after a while you don't even remember the drive, like, you're on autopilot.
Yes.
And it doesn't mean that the driving is less, you know, dangerous or complex or anything like that, but that certain markers, you trust the process. Like, you know how to get home, it's good.
Yep, that makes sense. And of course, sometimes when you're writing a character, I don't know if this is your experience, but it's certainly mine. You've mapped them out. You know where you want them to go, and then you begin to write the character, and you're like, oh, this person would never do that.
Well,
like, this person has to go a different way to get to where I want them to go, and hopefully they'll go there.
Right, or they need to go a different way.
Yeah.
Like, completely, you know, like, where I want them to go isn't right, and you have to rework things. My only problem is, and I this is where I get frustrated by that whole concept, is a lot of times people refer to it as, like, well, the character, you know, writes itself. No, actually, that you're still writing. Like, don't throw out your ability.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, don't downplay your ability. It just means that you built the character correctly. And that, like life... You know, it's like, I might want to go to the bookstore today, let's just say.
Right.
And all I plan to do is just, you know, go to the bookstore. But maybe, you know, like, whatever. Like, I'm like, oh, we'll meet up. We'll go to the bookstore. And then I meet up with someone. And I'm like, oh, and we end up watching a movie instead. Or we go somewhere else first. Or whatever. It's not a failure of plot. It's that any good character has... The character is in the unwritten spaces.
Right.
And so those unwritten spaces are how they're choosing to do things, if that makes sense. Like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of how to explain that better for other people. But yeah, it's, you know, you can ask, like, because any character is essentially, like, the basic questions of, like, what do they want? What are they willing to do to get it? And how do they act when they lose? And how do they act when they win, I guess. You don't worry as much how they act when they win, because they often don't. not until later.
Right.
But yeah, the better you build out a character, and, like, I don't believe in the, I know people who do them, who do, like, questionnaires for their characters, you know, have you ever seen those?
No.
God, I know so many people who rely on these, like, they do questionnaires, like, personality quizzes, and they answer them in character so they know their character. Like,
oh,
what's your favorite band?
Thought about this.
What's your
right.
favorite color? You know, like, what was your childhood pet? And they answer all this, I'm like, no. No, I don't want to answer any of that until I need that information.
Hmm.
And if I understand the character enough, it becomes a thing.
Right.
I mean, if you look at, like, Leverage, for instance, like, they didn't write any more backstory for Parker in the first episode than was on screen. But when they get to like, oh, here's Archie, and she was, you know, raised by this thief, and all that, like none of that existed until it was needed.
Right.
But if you had mapped that out too early, it wouldn't have been there.
Hmm.
You know, like you have to. That's why I hate that character thing, because I'm like, I don't care what my character's favorite fucking band is almost ever. Like, unless it's going to come up in the story. And right. If it's going to come up in the story, I don't want to know until I need that answer. Because that answer is accumulation of what they're saying, what they're doing, how they're behaving as I go. And my first feel of the character. Like, I usually don't start a story until I can sit down and write a conversation with a character. Like, mm-hmm. I need to hear their voice in my head correctly. Because that's for me, that first choice, right?
Gotcha.
And then every choice accumulates, and the more choices they have, even if it's just like, what did they order at this diner? But again, like, I don't know before I get there, right? Like I actually just had a character who's in a diner and ordered what was like a salad and fries. And I'm like, that's a weird meal.
Yep, a little
but
bit.
You can see it, right? Like, it makes sense. But then I had them, like, sit there and eat the salad first, and the other character is sitting there thinking, like, their priorities are wrong. Like, eat the hot thing first. What's wrong with this? And it kind of tells you a lot about both characters without mm-hmm. telling you anything, if you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know exactly what you
so,
mean.
So, yeah, I don't like defining stuff before I need to define it, just because it closes doors. And right. Writing is about opening doors.
Gotcha. Well, I like that.
Because again, like every choice is the accumulation of everything that character has done. And I don't know. I can, like, I don't know, like, your favorite color. I don't know what your first pet's name was. I don't know what your favorite band is, but like, I know you well enough that I could probably be like, oh, you'd like this movie. You know, I could judge how you would do in a certain scenario.
Exactly.
But, and from that, I could probably extrapolate backwards, but knowing it frontwards doesn't help.
Mm-hmm.
And would probably lead me down the wrong path, because it's the choices, it's the accumulation of data rather than hard, weird data points.
Yes, exactly.
So that's, I'm sorry, it's one of those weird things that just drives me nuts with the, and then the character wrote themselves, like, fuckers, no.
Well, you know who said that at one point? Mm. Nobel Prize winning author Toni Morrison.
Sure. Look, lots of very great writers who are much smarter than me say that and believe that. And if that's their process, it's great. But I am very firmly in the there is no magic here.
Actually, I have to get on Twitter right now and say Adam P. Nave says Toni Morrison is full of shit.
But no, I'll tag her
in the conversation.
Perfect. No, I hate the idea of writing as magic.
Yeah, I understand. I mean,
it's something that writers came up with to make themselves sound cool.
I love that. I mean, I think if there's something about it, like when you're in the zone with writing.
Yeah.
It's sort of, it can feel kind of magical.
Sure.
I mean, there's moments, and I think they can. People take that and they spin it too far. Like, writers say that. And I think they also say it to, like, it's like they make themselves feel cool. It just adds to the mystique for
right, you
for
want that
the,
mystique,
because
what else do you have, right?
Exactly.
Or just as a writer, like, you just don't want to, and again, like, I always think of writing as building furniture or building cars.
Fair enough.
It's a mechanical job, and that doesn't mean that there's not, like, beauty and grace in it. But also, if you think that that does mean that, you've never seen really beautiful furniture.
Right.
Like, there is beauty and grace in anything artistic. That doesn't mean it's not also a mechanical process. The it feels like magic thing, being in the zone, is one of those things for me that, and this is something I've tried to explain to people, because, you know, I do editing and story consulting and all this, so I talk to a lot of new writers.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, there's a translation matrix in your head. There is. Because you're constantly telling yourself stories, right? Like, that's the human condition.
Right.
You are narrating your own life, whether you're doing it to the point that you can hear it in that little voice in your head or not. You're narrating your own life. That's what memory is and all that. Okay.
Yeah.
What you think of as a story, like, when you're, like, telling yourself a story, even when you're, like, thinking of writing, versus what ends up on the page is always different.
Oh, yes.
There's a translation matrix in your head that goes from the subconscious, which is where you actually write, to the conscious, which is where you're thinking about what you're writing, down to a mechanical process of moving your fingers to either write longhand or type, or speak, however you're actually getting the words down, right? And somewhere in that process, it shifts, and there you cannot get 100%.
No.
Because it is, there's a translation matrix, and it's slightly broken. There's just something about how it works, because, again, like, you don't know that when you're in the zone, you're essentially bypassing the conscious thought part of it.
Right.
Which is what you want. But you also don't actually know, here's the trick, you don't actually know what your subconscious is thinking. You can't, by definition.
Yeah.
So what you think of as a story is already one step removed. What you're typing, even when you're in the zone, is a different step removed, and when you're looking at it and reading it, you're reading it from an expectation that's now two steps removed, because you're reverse translating it back? From, like, the mechanical to the conscious, and then comparing it to something that you can't actually access? Fuck, that doesn't work. Which is why it feels like you can never get the thing that you're actually writing. I might spend way too much time thinking about this stuff.
That's okay. I know exactly what you mean. I mean, it's like your first sort of fumbling attempts at making a story work. Like, I don't know if you have this particular thing, or you come up with like a line or like a paragraph, and you look at it and you're like, oh fuck, this is entirely different than what I wanted. And now everything, if I keep this, this whole thing now has to be different unless I scrap it and do something radically different again. It's a humbling and sort of amazing experience at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, well, with novels, it's something that I do when I'm starting a book. Like, after I already have the plot and I already have the characters, which I kind of... people are like, which did you come up first? It's like, kind of the same time. I can't really separate that into stages.
Right.
Because the plot, as I'm coming up with it, is being informed by the character, but it's also informing the character.
Right.
It's a two-way street, so they're kind of happening at the same time. But I do tone tests, and I will write, like, the first, like, up to 5,000 words of the novel, and then delete it. And then do it again. Like, I've thrown out, like, 40,000 words before I even start a book.
That's pretty good.
Just because until I get, like, the word choices right and the shape of the paragraphs, which people laugh at me for, but it matters. You know, long paragraphs read differently than short paragraphs, right?
Yep, they do.
And it's like how the sentences are formed, what word choices I'm making, and how does this person speak? And you just run it through, like, I know what it should be. I know where it needs to be for character. And until my brain goes, oh, right, this is it. You have to keep trying, and I think that, like, a lot of people will just kind of keep going and then slowly drift into it. And I'd rather just, like, spend the extra, like, week throwing out a bunch of work that's wrong.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
They're gonna pare it away
and
find it right the first time. The first time.
Well, it's like when you read a piece by somebody who maybe is newer to writing.
Yeah.
And you perceive very quickly that the first... 5 pages, the first chapter even, is essentially just throat clearing and figuring it out. And they haven't, and they're too wedded to the words. They don't want, they just don't want to throw it out because it's their words, right? So.
Right, no, they're precious. And that is part of why I just completely delete them, because it's humbling in a weird way. Like, it's constantly humbling. I just spent, like, you know, a couple hours doing, like, this 5,000 word chunk, and that's great. And I'm just going to delete it like it never happened and do it again. And it's just, it brings you back down to earth to none of this is sacred.
Right. Yes.
You know, you are in service of the story. Anything else is a mistake. And so it kind of keeps me grounded that way. Once I get past it, like, 5,000-10,000 word mark, I don't, I try very hard not to edit while I write. I'll make notes for, like, I should remove this, I have to go back and add this. But otherwise I just get lost in that cycle of editing what I'm writing instead of writing.
Speaking of which, just as a side note, I've started reading N.K. Jemisin's trilogy, the one for which she seems to be
which she set records for with Hugo's. Yeah,
yeah, just the Hugo magnet. I'm just thinking of this trilogy.
What's funny, I haven't read this trilogy.
Oh, I've never read Jemisin before, and I just started with it. It is, and it's very like her world building is really unusual. It's
Yes.
and I've never really encountered anything quite like it before. So, and it's almost she seems to be building it up in at least in the first chapter of the first book. I've read a little further than that now. But she seems to build it up not so much by setting out facts or just like having like concentrated character pieces that reveal the world, but it almost feels like a series of impressions that by the time you begin to get into the story, you realize you've already started the story element, you've already started the plot, but it sort of started happening at some point you didn't quite detect. So it's yeah, it's impressive and very different, and I can immediately see why she's like just wiping up Hugo's. So,
Yeah, no, I read the first trilogy,
right.
which I'm forgetting, which is that the Inheritance trilogy?
I think that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, because this one is the Broken Earth trilogy, right? Yeah, I read the
Right.
Inheritance trilogy, a few years ago, and it was one of those like, holy shit, like this, she is going to be bigger than anything. You could feel it even in that. Like, there's just that. Like, it just slowly like accrues to just there is like you said, like there's an interesting sense of world building, there's a great sense of prose, like everything is clicking over. Yeah, no, my big problem, actually, I mentioned the bookstore as a joke, but I actually want to go to the bookstore. My big problem is that I can't read fiction while I'm writing prose,
Right, exactly. Yeah,
and I've been stuck in the cycle of writing novels, so I'm like dreadfully behind on my prose, like my fiction reading.
Right. Well, when you emerge, I recommend you a bit of Jemisin. I
Oh
mean,
yeah,
I
it's on the
hardly need to
list.
tell you. Yeah.
Oh man, yeah, I'll tell you more about the whole writing cycle thing after we when we're not recording.
Sure.
But
But
yeah,
we
no,
already,
it's
yeah. So let's
so yeah.
so now that we've talked
Sorry,
about writing and what makes that's
I
okay.
completely
Now that
derailed
we've
us
got
there.
yeah, we talked a bit about Killjoys, and I always find that because Killjoys is so consistently good, I mean,
Right.
I often find myself trying to find something to say besides "wasn't that good?"
Sure.
I mean, although the way it swerved into us talking about writing was delightful, so let's talk about a show where the writing is not working, and that's this episode of Winona Earp.
Okay, now that's interesting, because I really like this episode.
Really? Oh my God, I had real problems with it.
I thought it was a really fun, because again, this is like their midpoint for the season.
Right.
And I thought it was a really fun kind of let's move two characters forward, but let's have fun with it. Like, let's just go completely ridiculous in this one way while we're
Okay.
dealing with some heavy kind of plot moving in the other hand.
Okay. Well, see, it didn't work for me. Because it just to me this episode kind of felt like somebody like it had a writer. I mean, although obviously that's not how writing rooms work in TV shows, but they brought in a writer who was like, here's the show Bible, write an episode. So they looks like they read it. I'm like, well, let's see, Winona's a loose cannon and Officer Hodd is kind of by the book. Hey, let's generate conflict between them.
Well, but I mean, there
And it
always has been. That's the thing. It's like there always has been, and it's never come to a head. And at some point, you need to resolve it, especially now that you don't have dolls around to kind of buffer, because that was always
Right.
their buffer.
Right.
And
That's
so yeah,
true.
and I think that like if we're gonna move like, you know, Officer Hot into being Sheriff Hot, like we need to have this settled. Because suddenly she's the only point of contact.
Right.
And so you need like her in order to be able to work together, but still have their friction.
Yeah. Yep. No, there's.
And I thought
I
doing it as
just.
comedy, like with the like just bad luck, and just kind of that constant like one-upping ridiculous, let it feel kind of low stakes while it was still doing a whole lot of heavy character lifting.
Okay.
But that doesn't like I just kind of liked the broadness of it with just because again I don't know, it was just it was legitimately funny when it wanted to be legitimately funny.
It was like, yeah, there were moments. I mean, actually, this had to me. This is going to be for at least for me. This is always going to be one of those episodes of the show that I didn't enjoy as much. But there are a couple of moments that I will remember as like being some of the funniest little moments
Well, and it's
in
like
the
for me, it was
series.
the beginning of the episode. There was a line in the beginning of the episode that kind of made me go, "Okay, this is what this episode's gonna be."
Okay.
And it was, you know, Winona coming out of the place and Hotch just going, let me guess, you need a ride. And her, I had a ride,
had a
I
ride.
Need a nap, need a also nap. A ride yeah. home. And I was just like, okay, so that's where we're going today.
Yeah, that's that was a good line. Mine was the when they're in the Revenant bar, and the guy says, oh, what are you good at? And they both answer at the same time, but Winona says drinking and Hot says Golden Girls trivia.
Girls trivia, yeah, that was just... And I want him to pick Golden Girls trivia, god damn it. That would have been delightful.
I know. That to me would have been like the best possible move, and have like Hot just like killing it, and everybody else just going, what the fuck? We're having like a Revenant who absurdly is really good at Golden Girls trivia.
Like New Them or something. Yeah, just like whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
B. Arthur is a Revenant.
Oh, that would have been delightful. There are other things, and here's another thing. It reminded me, and this maybe this was part of it, but it was calling out rather specifically to, and maybe unintentionally, to a really bad episode of Buffy, where a troll comes out of an artifact, and turns out in that case it used to be like a part like an old boyfriend of like one of the characters. But it was sort of like weirdly similar. I also thought Bunny's character, like, and there are other things, like Bunny's character, like, is just paper thin. But that's okay.
Right.
And like, but when the two frat guys show up and they steal the car, and she's in the back shouting at Winona and Cole, I'm like, this doesn't make a lick of sense.
Well,
and just having like
bad luck
talisman
doesn't
work.
Well, see, once we hit the bad luck talisman thing, I was like, okay, now we have the grounds to do anything at all.
Yeah.
No matter how absurd, because we just go, well, but what are the chances, and just run with it. And if
right.
it was an everyday thing, it would have annoyed me. But I think for me, it echoed the fun episodes of Warehouse 13.
Oh, yeah,
like,
I
it was
that.
Very much an episode of Warehouse 13. Like, you could sub in, like, you know, Latimer for Winona type of thing.
Right.
And I always love that
man.
Kind of, like, goofy interplay and, like, we're going to have fun with it. So I think it hit me in that, like, weird, like, Warehouse 13 sweet spot.
Hmm.
And I was willing to run
nice.
With it. It's not what the show should be weekly.
No.
More than once a season. It shouldn't go this hard into that camp.
Okay.
But as, like, a one-off, like, we're going to have fun. Also because, frankly, the whole bit with the mother and Doc just dragged a little bit for me.
It did drag. It was at least one or two scenes too long.
Right. So having the ridiculousness helped buffer that for me.
I was also kind of curious about a couple of moments, like when she says she's leaving. It's like, now that I know what happened to Julian, but there's no indication. Like earlier, she tells Doc what happened to Julian, but didn't she always know? It felt, and like there are just bits when I thought. Like, for example, they say, oh, he's not an ogre, he's a gnome. I'm like, but you didn't establish that you thought he was an ogre, really? It felt
right.
like there were bits cut from this episode.
There might
like
have been
it was
for
too
time,
long.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, and it was cut for time, and there are little bits and pieces left kind of dangling.
Entirely possible.
And another thing I thought that kind of disappointed me quite a lot, it wasn't in the comedy, it was in those scenes where they do the heavy lifting. Greg Lawson, who plays Sheriff Nedry,
uh-huh.
when he says to Nicole, you're like a daughter to me,
oh, God.
He delivers the shit out of that line, but it just, I was like, you've read the script, haven't you? Like,
look,
you
one
know
of those things of sometimes, and this is something like I get yelled at because I don't do it, and sometimes in writing, and again, like I said, you learn that you have to do this. Sometimes you have to just play to the cheap seats.
Yeah.
Even when you don't want to, because there are those people who are like half watching or are just coming in, you know, like maybe they just came in this season so they don't have all the backstory. And it's like you're just gonna play this line to the cheap seats and just be like, just by the way, we're gonna be so on the nose it hurts for like just forgive us. It's a thing.
Fair enough.
And some shows don't, you know, you don't have to do it. But again, it's you risk audience loss when you don't do it. And every now and then you have
you know,
to play it.
Yeah, I mean, and kudos on this show for being like a crazy supernatural sort of like fantasy dramedy that usually manages to get its emotions across without doing that.
Right.
I just think that Nedry is, he's really kind of like an unsung character, and but he's sort of like this backbone that's always, he's always there.
Right.
Right. And you know, so he starts as like, you know, in the beginning of the show, he's just like kind of this stick in the mud guy who seems to be like a foil for Winona. And he gradually emerges as like a complex character. And this really seems the culmination of his arc. And when he says, actually, when he says, "I'll be around," you think, oh, shit, he's probably going to die soon.
Right. This is the episode that made me want to see a series of him as sheriff without like Black Badge, with, you know, occasionally without, you know, I mean, because again, like the last heir died and Winona wasn't old enough and had left. There's a period of time, like 18, 20 years probably.
Right, where he's the one.
Where
he's keeping,
right, the peace and not being able to tell anyone and working around everyone. He has that big safe full of stuff. Like, I want to see that.
Yeah, oh, totally.
And I love that they did enough lifting very carefully with him that became a thing that you wanted. And it made me kind of sad that they hadn't found the time before now.
I agree. I do agree. I thought I was... Yeah, when I was watching this, I'm like... Yeah, Nedry. He's like they do a lot of good work with Nedry in this episode. That one scene.
Yeah.
But I was, like I said, I was disappointed that they did play to the cheap seats. I wanted something different. But I guess
agree.
Maybe that's,
I think it would have been better with it. I don't know. Like, there are certain shows I'm like, and again, like when a show's good and when I'm enjoying it, I will forgive that, like playing to the cheap seats if they're doing it every couple episodes. Because you need to. It's like, if you remember in the old days, when any show you could count on, that they would essentially be recapping and redoing the emotional beats of the pilot for the first six episodes. Because you have to wait for people to tune in. And that's kind of gone away, thank God. But like, you know, back then, like, it's like, okay, I get it. I'll sit through this because you're not talking to me. You're talking to these other people who need it. And fuck it, if it works and it gets more people in, I get more shows, so I'm willing to forgive it.
Right. Fair enough.
It's a trade-off moment for me. You know, the end bit with Doc was great. I thought they really sold the hell out of that moment.
They did, and I still find Doc's decision a bit of a mystery. I'm like, is he up to something? Because there's that beginning in the beginning of the show, when, you know, the Contessa says, you know, it's what you wanted, and he's looking in the mirror and watching himself kind of disappear, and he says, it's what, you know, what I wanted. And I'm like, Is there an end game to like
Doc's
decision
here? Well, I don't think there is for him past just, we've seen that he is ruled by fear, and he became so used to being immortal that when he had to give it up, that's all he wants back. I feel like the whole Bolshar thing will cure him of vampirism. Like, he's not going to be a vampire for like next season. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
But like, they'll figure out a way to keep him immortal. Like, this is going to be the game with Doc.
No. Yeah. Yeah, I think I don't know. I guess maybe there's an aspect that's weird. I don't usually feel this way when I'm watching shows with characters. There's an aspect of that character, and I don't want him to be as small and ruled by fear as I think it turns out he is.
Right.
I mean, maybe it's just a, because I keep on thinking, oh no, he's got a plan, but maybe it's just a low point for him.
Yeah,
maybe,
no, and
that's
actually one of the things I like about the character, is that he is this guy who comes off like he's the coolest guy in the room. He always has this great plan. But the more you look at it, the more you're like, no, actually, he's ruled by fear. And his best moments, he gets past it. But that's the start of the character when we first meet him, right? Like, that's his history with Wyatt.
Yeah.
Is that he's this small man ruled by fear. And, you know, eventually throughout the course of the show type of thing, It's the great hope. Like, his great moment is finally moving past that.
Yeah.
So, like, he has this arc that's being set up, and I think he's in the middle of it right now, which is always that low
point. All right. Yeah, the point at which the character regresses, and then but must come through it with what's the classic formulation? Must come through it with new powers.
Right, well,
<that's>
the,
or something
because,
like that.
Well, because if you look at it, like last season, he looked like he had moved forward and he was willing to give up the immortality for this whole thing, even though he was like upset about it, he was fighting through that because he knew it was the right thing, and that forced the regression. Like, it makes sense from an arc point of view, it makes sense for the character, but it is upsetting because it's not what you want for him. which for me is how I know it's working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like all the best shows, like, well, drama shows that aren't like just heavily serialized. If you look at like Person of Interest, right? Like Person of Interest is always kind of at its height when you're worried that like John was regressing.
Yeah.
You know, or Root was sliding backward. Like that's where your tension comes from. It's the I don't want this for them, but I want them to be happy. But this is the path through.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. This is actually, it's funny with this episode, because this is one of these moments when I always wish that you had been like a Buffy watcher.
I know.
Because this I know. Because this episode calls out to that show even more heavily than usual for Winona Earp. Because there's a lot about it that reminded me of very much of a often, like in some cases, kind of a subpar episode of Buffy, but also the entire interaction between Doc, who is now a vampire, and Winona, who is sort of like the lone protector of a particular place.
Right.
I was like, oh shit, we're now in the middle of season two of Buffy. Specifically, we're in the moment when Buffy like kicks him out of the house and leaves Angel in the cold. So I'm like, this is fascinating. The circumstances are different, but it's, if you watch the show, it's just the similarities are so glaring that Winona Earp is begging you to like notice them.
That's fair. I can't speak to it because I wouldn't know. Oh man. Oh, so just moving away from Winona Earp, because I don't know what else either of us has to say about that. Because I am going to be curious to see, just because Killjoys is 10 episodes and Winona Earp is usually 13, how they're going to play those last three episodes, because Killjoys will be done. So like, do they just play? Do they double up? I don't know. I'm always I know that's a weird thing to be curious about, but it's one of those things I'm always curious about.
I too am curious.
But so I was watching. I don't usually watch Amazon Prime stuff that often, and there's no reason for that. Like I have Amazon Prime and I have, you know, the Amazon Video stuff, but I just don't end up watching movies through it that often.
Right.
There's no real reason for this, just I don't. Oh, apparently, sorry, this season is 12 episodes, so...
My guess is then, because
10 will air the same time as the last episode of Killjoys for the season. My guess is then that 11 and 12 will be a two-parter.
Oh, that would be delightful.
But anyway. And I found out there's a feature in Amazon Prime that I hadn't seen, that I'd never noticed. And I was talking to a friend about it, and I don't think it's something that you can access as easily if you watch on, like, PlayStation or, like, you know, through, like, some app on your TV. Because I'm watching it, like, on my computer in a browser, right? I just moved the mouse over by accident because I was doing something in another window. And, another monitor. And I moved the mouse over, and I got X-Ray. It has this X-Ray feature, which is the coolest thing ever if you watch it, like, on a computer. Because I was watching Get Shorty, which I hadn't seen in years. And I moved the mouse over the screen, and it popped up X-Ray, and there's a list of every actor in the scene who has a speaking role.
Oh, neat.
But, like, it's the scene where, like, they're in the restaurant having lunch with Danny DeVito's character. And so it's like, you know, like, obviously, like, Rene Russo, Danny DeVito, da da. And there's, like, the maitre d' and their waitress.
Oh, cool.
So it's like everyone who has a speaking role, they have this little, like, X-Ray thing so you can see, like, who the actor is.
Man.
I just thought that was awesome.
That is great.
Because it is just scene by scene. It just changes. So yeah, if you watch Amazon Prime like on your computer itself, and you just like mouse over into the window, you'll just get that X-ray view.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
I'm sure there's a way to pull it up in other ways, you know, there has to be.
Yeah, well, maybe, boy, that would be something I'd love to see on Netflix. Like that kind of like fine grained detail about it.
Right, I can't imagine how much time they'd spend, because I'm like, it's not like a lot of people are watching Get Shorty, right? Like the idea that they did it for even that means that they've done it for everything, doesn't it?
Hope, yeah, man.
And it's just because it's every speaking role, and it was great because later on I was like, who is it? Like this actress looks familiar. I can't figure out who this person is, but like I swear I've seen them before. And I was like, oh wait, and just move the mouse over the screen for a second.
Neat.
So yeah, that's really handy.
Cool. I should try. I'm in the middle of a really really terrible Amazon Prime movie right now. I don't think I'm going to finish it, but
yeah.
It was one of the ones that pops up in top movies recommendation,
uh-huh.
And it's this like 80s like cheapo exploitation film called Evils of the Night, which turns out to be aliens.
Okay.
Oddly wandering around a regular looking hospital when. Maybe they're supposed to be wandering around like a futuristic. I don't know. It's actually one of those times when you see a movie and you're like, oh, that's going to be so much fun. And you start watching and you're like, actually, this is fucking dumb.
And, whoops.
Yeah. But I should kick up or boot up Evils of the Night just to see if they'll do the X-ray feature on that.
You never know.
You never know. I mean, these are not... Actually, it has the craziest cast. Like, it's got like... I can't even remember, but the names kept on coming up, and I'm like, what the fuck are these people doing in this shit movie? Like, Tina Louise is in a scene, and I'm like, what? Why? And so on and so forth. So...
You know. Yeah, Julie Newmar is in it.
Yes, there you go. Julie Newmar, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But I didn't watch far enough to get to. I only watched like the first maybe 15 minutes. So I don't recommend it, by the way.
I looking at the poster, I see why. but Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, that's right.
Cat driving me insane.
Speaking of tech things, real quick. New phone. I have
new
a new phone. I have an iPhone 8.
Okay.
And I have transitioned over from an iPhone SE, which when I got a couple of years ago, I thought would be like the perfect phone for me because it had
sure.
the guts of an iPhone 6, essentially packed into the size of an iPhone 5, and I'm like and it had the sort of the power button in the right spot for me instead of the side. It was on the top, which I really liked.
Right.
And it had and of course it had the headphone jack. Which, and I have a light meter peripheral that uses the headphone jack, so I was like, okay, I'll keep on with that. But I found that apps and were clearly not designed for that screen size.
Yeah.
Anymore. So using almost any app was kind of frustrating and weird, and in some cases unusable, especially when you had to like call up like password fields and paste text in. It was just a complete mess, which often was just like shitty coding on the developer's part.
Sure.
But it affected me.
Right, of course.
And my phone. So I just got the iPhone 8 the other day, which has, and I love this, it has like the home button is really, it's not really a button, it's just like a depression and you get haptic feedback. Which I'm never sure how I feel about the haptic feedback, because it kind of sounds like, or kind of feels to my mind like the sort of like weird hiccup a drunk makes right before throwing
up
everywhere.
Oh yeah, no, I know what you mean. I have a Galaxy S8 Plus, and it doesn't have a home button at all, like not even like a circle for it, it is on the screen.
Oh. Oh,
but it has
okay.
that haptic
yeah.
feedback. You press it,
and it goes hiccup.
And it does that little stutter. Yeah.
Yeah, and I remember when I love reading reviews of people raving about haptic feedback, and guaranteed these are the same people who mocked the BlackBerry Storm years ago for having the exact same mechanism. People just like to rag on BlackBerries. But yeah, it's, and I find that I tend to use. Phones like I use my cameras, which is that I buy these devices with like a million functions, and then I'm like, I like those three functions,
right?
And I will use nothing, and I don't give a shit about all the other cool things that it can do because it's just too much trouble. I'm just right. like, I like these dials, I like this couple things, I'm done. But the 8 has it's actually much more pleasant to use than the SE. Just haptic feedback aside, it's just that much faster. The battery drains remarkably quickly, even with the settings. But it charges. I have a wireless charger because I got it on a deal. So
right.
The wireless charger just it's a little stand, so you can kind of put it by my computer,
oh,
and
yeah.
I can use just tap away at my phone as needed. So it's
see, yeah. I realized because my last like two or three phones have all because you know I use Android. Not I moved away from the iPhone back like the iPhone 3.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved over to like Android stuff, and so I've had like wireless charging forever to the point where like this phone, I had to plug it in once, and I was like, weird, I've never done this before, because I have like a wireless charger at my desk that my phone is on now, and I have one by my bed.
Yeah. Yep.
So I had to plug it in like once.
It's funny actually. I have this one charger by my computer, but I like it enough that I might just get another one, literally for my bedside.
Oh yeah,
and it's because it is the thing. It's like one of these times when it's like the thing you need, but you didn't know you needed it.
Oh yeah, no, like I used to, you know, obviously like you know I had a stand for my phone so I could during when I was working, I could always see it.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I get like a message or anything else, or like sometimes my mail clients will update slow, my phone will get it first for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see like, oh, I have this email. I should go look at this client type of thing. Or if I get a call on that for whatever reason. But it's always like, okay, well now I have to like go somewhere and I have to plug it back in when I sit back down and all this. And now it's just like, I just set it down. It's fine.
Nice. Sorry. So the, iPhone 8?
The only problem. Oh yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Oh no, so go, tell me the only problem first.
The only problem with wireless charging I found is that sometimes I will be in bed and I'll be like, oh, get up in a few minutes type of thing. Like if I take a nap or it's in the morning and I don't feel like getting up yet, I will lay in bed and mess around with my phone for a little bit.
Mm.
Like look up stuff, like read the news, whatever it is, right?
Right.
And when it was plugged in, it was great because I could sit there and do that and then I would still get out of bed with a fully charged phone. With wireless charging, I can't do that.
Ah, right.
Because, yeah.
Yeah, that's
so that's
true.
The only downfall.
Yeah, and but I tell you, other than that, I know exactly what you mean. Other than that, I'm a big fan. Although now that this thing is the screen is a little larger and the display is better than the SE, also the phone reception is better.
Yep. Bigger antennas.
That because it's like a lot more of a pleasure to read. Like I found myself last night at like literally 3 a.m, like going oh. Maybe I will read this like itemized ranking of all episodes of you know, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And then around 3:30, I was like, "What the fuck am I doing?"
See, I have
seen half these episodes.
I have my phone. I don't know if iPhones do this, but I have my phone. It has a night mode.
Yeah.
To where you can turn on like a blue filter.
Yep.
Which is easier to read in the dark, but it also does. While it's easier to read in the dark, it's also not easier to read in general.
Okay.
And so I have it set that to like where it switches over every night and comes back every morning. And partially that's for the like that same thing.
Right.
But I'm like, oh yeah, the color's different. I shouldn't even be looking at this. Like,
yeah, I know it has a night mode. I just literally got this 2 days
yeah,
ago,
yeah.
So I haven't really investigated everything that's in it.
Yeah,
but
no,
it is my tech pick of the week.
That's fair. I keep thinking about going back to iOS sometimes. You know, doing with the Apple phone thing. Just because I'm agnostic.
Yeah, no, I get you.
But I haven't, because for my personal use case, there's enough stuff that, like, I can't do. My big thing is, in Android that you can do is you can have widgets. And so I have, like, on my home screen, I have a scrollable calendar that has, like, all my appointments and all that. That I can easily see, like, 3 to 4 days ahead right there. And then I have a full screen which has my full monthly calendar on it.
Ah.
And I swear by that because I have so much, you know, it's like, oh, I have this editing call here. I have this here. I have to go do this there. Like, I was joking with somebody. Like, I had, like, a Skype call with them for an editing thing. And they're like, yeah, but we're just going to do the call in like an hour. And I'm like, I'm still going to add, like, I'll invite you to this calendar thing. But we don't need that. I was like, if it's not my calendar, it doesn't exist. Like, I have to play it that way just because I have enough deadlines and enough weird shit going on. That, like, sometimes I will be like, oh, I'm going to, like, the bookstore with this person at, like, 4. I'll put it in the fucking calendar sometimes. Just because I live and die by my calendar. And yeah. So being able to see it the minute I, like, turn on my phone is invaluable to me. Like, I don't have to go to another screen. And you know, it's just the level of customization where it's like, I'm bored with the look of these icons. Like, that... like, I want to make a fun pattern with these because I don't have enough to fill a screen. Like, I don't know. It's just iOS is okay.
Yeah, you are sort of a little bit less. There's a little less freedom with iOS than with Android systems.
And there are things that iOS does way better. So you know, it's whatever works.
Yeah.
I just moved to like that Samsung Galaxy family back when because I had an iPhone 3. Because you know, I went from like the Palm to like the Trio to an iPhone. And it died, and I just ended up moving to the Android thing just because I was curious.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I'll try this for a minute. I've never been able to switch back. I always kind of think about it, like, maybe I should. No. What's funny is the number of other, like, because I use a PC at home, but I actually have an iPad mini and an iPod Classic.
An iPod Classic?
I have an iPod Classic that I got off of eBay that was retrofitted. They removed the hard drive. They put in an SD card that has twice the capacity, so it's like a 256 gig iPod Classic.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And put in a new rechargeable battery.
Oh. That seems like the best of all possible worlds.
Right.
Yeah.
And I got it because at the time when Lazo was still living here, it was the music for the car. And when I'm like working on the treadmill, I can just plug it into the treadmill has speakers and a port, and I can just plug that in right there to listen to music. And it's like I got an iPad mini on like deep discount sale type of thing. Like they're moving out some old stock. It's like a generation old. Just for on the bar, which is partially in the kitchen, so also for the kitchen, I have a Bluetooth speaker and I have this iPad mini that has all my music on it. So I can listen to music there, we can take it out to the patio and all this. And I also have like Evernote, which is where I keep all my recipes. So when I'm cooking, I just have them all right there. That's all I use it for. That's it. It's just recipes and music.
No, I like that.
But yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like, I'm agnostic. Like, I could totally have done these things with something that was Android or anything else. And, you know, get a Zune, it doesn't matter.
I remember I borrowed a friend's Zune one time. It was a fascinating experience.
Right? But I just did this just because of the ease of syncing all the music over from iTunes. Because I keep all my music in iTunes still on my desktop.
Cool. Yeah.
And I have an Android thing that'll do it. But it's never quite as clean.
Right.
Because I always, backup-wise, have all my music. Well, not all my music, but I have most of my music also on my phone. Just in case. Because, again, like it doesn't matter now that I'm in Portland. But when I was in New York, it was like I'd listen to music, you know, instead of a Walkman, listen to it on my phone.
Right.
And so, like, habit-wise, I still have it just in case.
Gotcha. Oh, hey. One thing I found out, the iPhones now come with... like, you know, 8 and up, maybe even 7 and up, I'm not sure. Their base memory is now 64 gigabytes, which is... I mean, I'm not surprised, but I remember, like, my iPhone SE was, like, a 16 gig model, and it didn't matter to me because I didn't keep anything on it.
Right.
And so 64 still doesn't matter to me. But now that I know, I have this... It's a little bit of extra cushion of security in my mind.
Yeah, see, because I always keep my music on it. Like, I was always buying, like, the iPhone that had, like, the 128 gig. Like, I always had to have...
Because
I have a lot of music.
Right.
And so I always had to have, like, that giant-sized thing. And, like, and again, like, that's the other reason to stay on Android, right? Like, because, and this has kind of changed and then went back and all this, but you can put, like, my current phone, like, you can put an SD card in it for extra storage. So I just, you know, like, my phone only has, like, 32 or 64 gig. But I have an SD card with, like, 128 just for my music.
Gotcha. We're coming up close to the hour mark, but I would like to talk a little more, because I've been holding on to a couple of weeks ago. I watched Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Oh yes,
for the first time since I saw it in the theater.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Back. I think I may have seen it. Maybe not on opening night. Maybe on the first weekend. And I was remember because I was living in Saskatoon at the time, so I was going to university there. And I was going with some friends of mine that some recent friends, because I hadn't been living there for very long, and there were just people from a couple of my English classes.
Right.
And I tell you, and I feel like maybe I've told you this story before, but just in case I haven't, or your memory's bad, I'll tell it again. Is going to the theater, and then you get to an early scene, maybe the second or third scene, and Keanu Reeves is in it.
Right.
And this is like, I think pretty much, I mean, now we're witnessing sort of a renaissance of Keanu Reeves. Like he's John Wick and whatnot have sort of brought him back into the popular consciousness. And there's been a kind of a reevaluation, I think, of Reeves. But at this point, I think he was pretty much at the very height of his stardom. Like he was a huge, huge draw.
Yeah.
And I got to witness firsthand the moment when that, like, height of his career went from, like, a star in the sky to being, like, plunged into the depths of hell.
Uh-huh.
So he's in there, and, like, the camera's behind him, and then it switches around to the front so everybody can see his face. And I swear, like, the audience, like, the women in the audience just went like that, because it was like, holy fuck, that's Keanu Reeves' face, you know. It kind of short-circuited people's brains a little bit. And then he spoke, and a second, like, wave of sound went through the audience, but it was of just confusion and disgust. I just watched his entire sort of, like, sexual charisma just drain out of him.
He was wrong for the direction on that was wrong for him.
I know. It was all wrong. And I was like, shit, this is not... I remember, I mean, well, at the time, I was like, ah, fuck him. But in retrospect, it was like, that was really not his fault. He was directed
very
badly. Yeah,
no, it was like Dangerous Liaisons. Like, it's not his fault.
Yep.
He was put in the wrong vehicle. Like I said, I never had that moment of like, I don't like Keanu Reeves. Like, he was always just this guy I enjoyed watching because he had a sincerity to him, even, and the problem was, even when it wasn't called for.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was a low point. My biggest problem with the Bram Stoker's Dracula movie, which I think I use as a warning for all Dracula adaptations,
mm-hmm.
is your Renfield should never be more terrifying than Dracula. And Tom Waits in that fucking movie is the scariest goddamn motherfucker alive.
It's funny because it's weird because there are a couple of performances in that movie that are radically different than everybody else's, and one of them is Tom Waits' Renfield. Yeah, Tom Waits' like Renfield character is absolutely fucking frightening. There's like legitimate terror in his performance.
Yeah.
Also, his English accent, I thought was really good. Like he really did a good job of that, better than pretty much all the rest of the American actors. And the other performance that is radically different, I think, is Anthony Hopkins, who obviously is like, yeah, this is a total piece of shit. Okay, here I go. I'm just gonna do what I want, and it was delightful to see. But it was weird watching him, as they say, like, act in a different movie than pretty much everybody else. And again, that's on Coppola for just right. like letting people have too much free, like letting his actors just do what they wanted.
Yeah, I mean, and to be fair, like the Tom Waits thing, you know, they used actual insects. He didn't eat them, but he put them in his mouth and kind of moved them around for a minute and then spit them out.
Wow.
Because he didn't want to actually eat them because that was just cruel. But he was putting like just, you know, like some mealworms and fucking spiders in his mouth. Just like he was committing on a level that most people just don't.
My God.
Yeah, no, it's like, you know, Mystery Men. Like, Mystery Men is a fun movie, and then you get to Tom Waits, and just, like, that's the thing I always remember. It's like, you know, Heller. Say it with me. Heller. You know, it's just, he just steals everything when he's allowed to be in a film.
It is true. He really does.
And, yeah, no, it is, that like it became my watchword for a Dracula adaptation. It's just if your Renfield is scarier than Dracula, you have a serious problem.
Yes, indeed.
But that is actually informed, because like I was a kid when that came out, and I think that was like the first Dracula movie I'd seen.
Oh, okay.
Like it's just because I've never really been that big on vampires. And so it was like the first, and weirdly, like it kind of informed the Dracula isn't really that menacing. He's just like an entitled dick, which is vampires, frankly. So hey.
Yeah, I mean, really, yeah, Coppola leaned really hard into like Stoker's notion of Dracula as the sort of the foppish foreign aristocrat who's basically come to like, who's like got like weird old sexual perversions and has come to
Yeah, he's
corrupt the
entitled
English
nobility.
woman. Yeah, exactly.
But it also did cement in my head that Renfield is the scariest thing in the Dracula mythos, which is
Oh,
interesting. Like, because whenever I see
yes.
a Dracula thing now, if Renfield isn't terrifying, I'm kind of like, eh. But I get it because he shouldn't be as like, and that's my problem. It's like there's that push and pull in my head.
Right.
But yeah, every Renfield ever in my life has had to live up to Tom Waits. That's just how it goes. I didn't know his
Fair
music
enough.
then. I didn't know who he was.
Oh, wow.
Like, because again, like I tried to, because I didn't get into Tom Waits until I was in college.
Oh, okay. Well, fair. Well, I mean, I guess I didn't get into him until I was in college either, but I was in college before you were, so there you
Right. I mean,
go.
you know, I'm talking like, and it was just before. I think the Stoker's Dracula came out in 92. I was in college like nine. I graduated from high school in 93.
Ah.
So it's like there's this little teeny window where I just didn't know who Tom Waits was.
Right.
You know, he was just this guy in like a movie or two, because I think Mystery Men was before that too, right? Like,
Yeah.
let me look that up now because I'm curious.
Mystery Men, and he was also in Ironweed, which was a
Yeah, but I haven't seen that
fascinating.
personally. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
No, Mystery
Yeah.
Man was 99, so that was what I already know. Yeah,
Oh, geez, that's later
I
than
just
I
remembered
thought.
earlier. But yeah, no, like at the time, like said Dracula, like I had no clue who Tom Waits was. I had no reference point at all. There was just this terrifying fucking human being, who just, you know, like just scares you, and
Wow.
like because
Because
he's the only scary thing in the movie.
it's funny because when I watched it, I'm like, hey, it's Tom Waits. I was like really thrilled because I loved Tom Waits,
Sure.
right, at the time.
Right.
Loved his music. And he just come out, I think he was just at that point he had come out or was about to come out with Bone Machine, which is legitimately one of his like just terrifying albums. I mean, it's just
Oh yeah, no,
some
Bone
sort of
Machine
like
is a fucking
apocalyptic American
classic. Yeah,
basement.
and that was
Oh yeah.
92, so it was like the same time, right?
Yeah.
And you
Yeah.
can see like I don't think they actually informed each other, but you could feel it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's like I didn't know who Tom Waits was. I go off to college. A friend of mine, who had occasionally questionable music choices, but also had some Tom Waits. All he had was Bone Machine. Like that was it. That's all he
Oh,
knew of
yeah.
Tom Waits. And he was playing that. I was like, "Who the fuck is this?" Because it's just like, what the shit? And he was like, "Oh, it's
I
this guy called
know.
Tom Waits." And I'm like, "Okay, this is fucking fascinating." And I went to a friend of mine who knew like all the jazz in the universe. Like, do you remember Us Three, that band that like existed for a minute?
Yeah, they were great.
Right.
Oh my God, they had like a really good
Well,
album.
and they had a really good album because they were doing it through Blue Note, and they got access to the Blue Note archives to use for samples.
That's right.
And this is how into jazz my friend was. He found every sample that they used, like by hand and memory.
Whoa.
He was like, "Here," he'd be like, "I know where that drum line is," and would like find it.
Wow.
So I went to him and I was like, "Have you ever heard of this fucking cat Tom Waits? Like, I need to hear it." And he's like, "The fuck do you think I am?" And so I was pulling out like early Tom Waits, and I was like, "I actually like this even more."
Oh yeah, I remember the first time I ever encountered it was either Small Change or
Oh,
Nighthawks at the
Jesus, fucking
diner.
Small Change is my favorite still,
Yeah,
album-wise.
and it was just like, oh my God, 'cause I mean, my first encounter with Tom Waits was in the 80s with his Frank's Wild Years
Oh,
and
Jesus.
Rain Dogs,
Still can't
which was
stand
like the
that dog.
first and that was his first major shift, right, from sort of that bluesy sort of troubadour sort of figure,
Right, I mean, and
and
that
so
was the
on and
thing,
so forth.
because yeah, I heard Bone Machine. I was like, "This is cool," and then a friend played me Small Change and Blue Valentine. And
Oh
I was just
man.
like, "Okay,
Ah, oh, Blue
this is where I
Valentine,
want to
holy
live.
crap.
Like, these are fucking life-changing albums."
Yeah.
And then I discovered the early years collections, and
Oh
I
yeah.
will tell you that because I used to have to take the bus from Boston back to New York like almost every weekend, and so I'd usually leave at, like the first bus out, and it's like 5:36 in the morning. And so I'm just like exhausted and half awake, and you're kind of driving into the sunrise. And I always have my Walkman with me because I can't read on a bus because I get car sick.
Oh.
So,
it used to be the same for me. Not anymore, but when I was younger, yeah.
Yeah, no, I still, like, I can read on a train and, like, planes, I'm fine, but, like, cars, buses, I can't do it.
Okay.
But that's fine because I like listening to music.
Sure.
And I had the early airs thing and I hadn't listened to much of it because I had just gotten the cassette. And I turned it on, you know, to where I had been, and Old 55 came on. Like, not the Eagles Fuck You version that sucks, but, like, the original fucking, like, Tom Waits ballad, you know, which is terribly, if you listen to the lyrics, it's terribly about this guy who's just drunk driving home at the end of a night, like, it's already hitting morning, and he's just, you know, right? It's kind of a terrible heartbreak of a song, like so many Tom Waits songs, but I swear to God, like, listening to that song at, like, full fucking volume as you're driving into the sunrise, like, I am not a religious person, but that is as close to religion as I have gotten in a long time.
There we go.
That song still just does me it every time. You know, and again, like, things like his cover of Somewhere.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Jesus Christ, if you want to feel religion, there you go. Like, he just, he brings it. But again, like, and, like, I still didn't realize that this was fucking Tom Waits. And a friend was like, oh, we should watch this Bram Stoker Dracula thing. I'm like, eh, it's okay, except for, like, Renfield. And he's like, well, yeah, Tom Waits. I was like, wait, that's something, because I hadn't seen him outside of, like, an album cover. I was like, that's Tom Waits? It had never clicked in my head. And so I watched it again. I was like, oh, like, suddenly I'm just like, yes, more of this, you know? I didn't know he acted. I didn't know, you know, because why would I, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, that's great. It was, what else was he? He was in 12 Monkeys as, like, a homeless guy. Yep.
And, yeah, I Night on Earth. And Shortcuts.
Oh, my God, Night on Earth. Oh, and Shortcuts, oh, of
course.
Yeah,
where, like, Tom Waits and Lily Tomlin, which I did not know I had ever wanted, like, a celebrity marriage to happen until I saw those two on the screen.
Yeah. To the wheels fall off, baby.
Oh, fucking hell. Fucking Tom Waits. I told you my greatest Tom Waits story ever, right?
Tell it again.
Okay, I've been lucky enough to see Tom Waits live twice in my life.
Holy shit, you are lucky.
Most people don't get to see him twice, right? Like, much less
no,
once.
No, or I've never seen him live.
The second time he was doing one of his tours, and it was later, it was like, you know, 5-10 years ago now, I think. I can't remember which album it was off of, but he was doing a tour, and, like, his son was drumming for him at that point.
Oh.
And it was, like, in Ohio, so, like, me and a friend drove, and of course I don't drive, so he drove with another friend of ours to switch off, like, 13 hours out to Ohio, because there was traffic and all this bullshit.
Ooh.
Like, we actually did. We, like, road trip to Ohio for one night.
My God. Okay.
To go see, because you got Tom Waits tickets. You're fucking going.
Yeah.
And, like, I had, like, seats in, like, the fucking, like, fifth row. So I'm, like, just watching fucking Tom Waits work. This is not the greatest Tom Waits story. So before that, Katrina had happened. And they were doing a series. There were two different Katrina benefit concerts happening in New York over the course of, like, a week. One was at, like, Radio City. The other, I forget where it was.
Wait, so this is the hurricane, not the first girl I ever had a crush on.
Yes, the hurricane.
Okay. Sorry. Just being silly. All right, keep going.
So a friend of mine's like, he calls me up and he's like, look, if you look at the bill right now, there's a whole bunch of acts, like, you know, there's just random acts. It was one of these benefit concerts, there's like 15 people playing. And, like, Dave Matthews was supposed to play, and I'm like, that's a reason to not go, but fine. And he's like, I hear that they're about to late add Tom Waits to this ticket. And I'm like, yeah, but are they? And he's like, I don't know, but I hear it from, like, a few different sources that I think are reliable. He's like, we should buy fucking tickets, because if they add him and that becomes public, there will be no tickets.
Good point.
And he's like, and if it doesn't, then we can go. We can watch some of the bands. We can leave when we're fucking bored.
Yeah, we can,
like,
we can leave.
It was a reasonable price. It was like $35 for a ticket. Radio City, again, like 3 hours of music. Fuck it. Might as well go. Buy the tickets. Not 10 minutes later, they publicly announced Tom Waits is joining this fucking ticket.
Oh, nice.
So we go, and now it's Radio City, and it's a fucking party. People are, like, bands are showing up and playing, like, little Zydeco bands and all this shit. They're showing up to play, and they're doing, like, one or two songs. They're leaving, like, people who feel like paying attention to that act or paying attention to it. People also just, like, talking and drinking and hanging out type of thing otherwise, which is kind of rude.
Mm-hmm.
But you kind of get it, right? Like, 15 bands, like, not everyone's going to pay, like, close attention to everything.
Right.
So this is how the night's going for, like, an hour or two. Then they're like, okay, and they bring out Tom Waits. everyone shut the fuck up. Like, not a single person there was, like, daring to speak, because I think they realized they would have had their throat cut. Waits comes out, there's some sound problems, he threatens to leave.
Whoa.
Like, he starts walking off the stage, like, the sound guys are, like, waving at him to bring him back. He comes back, he's like, all right, I'll keep going. And instead of doing two songs, he does, like, five or six. No one's going to stop him.
So
like,
nice.
No one at this point, no one is going to interrupt Tom Waits and tell him to get the fuck off the stage. This is not a thing that happens. So for his last song, he does something that I swear to God, if you had told me on paper, I would not have believed this. This is the worst choice ever. Remember, Katrina benefit concert.
Mm-hmm.
He starts Let It Rain. Which is, for people who don't know, a song about how the flood should come and wash us all away because this has just hurt too much.
Mm.
This is not a song you sing at a Katrina benefit concert. Because you know, like, you're going to lose the whole audience, right?
Yeah.
Unless you're in Tom Waits, and you're going to fucking do it hard enough that everyone was crying.
Oh.
Like, he just destroyed the audience. He finishes the song, he's like, you know, thanks, good night, walks off, and they're like, okay, we're going to have, like, a 15-minute intermission, we're going to be back with Dave Matthews. Which is when we're like, okay, first of all, this is the worst night in Dave Matthews' entire career. Because how the fuck are you supposed to follow that? Like, you know, like, what asshole do you have following Tom Waits?
Yeah.
Much less that performance, who just brought all of Radio City Music Hall to tears. A good third of us, like, because people, like, wander outside and all this, I watched a good third of that, me included, just left. We're just like, we're done. Like, you can't follow that. We're not going to fucking, like, do it. We have to, like, especially for Dave Matthews. I'm sorry, but no. And all I can figure is, like, Dave Matthews once had the worst night of his fucking life. Because
yeah.
He comes on, so the place is, like, a third empty. And everyone who's there is just like, you're not fucking Tom Waits. Get off the stage. Like, there's just no way for him to win this night.
Maybe he took it to heart and said, okay, I'm never playing music again. I mean, this is...
I don't know. Like, I wasn't there for it. I like to think he just kind of, like, came out and he just, like, sat down and he's like, I'm not even gonna, I'm just gonna sit here. What's up? Like, I can't even do it. Like, just, fuck it. Just comes out, he's like, how is Tom Waits? We should talk about him. You know, just... So anyway, that's my great Tom Waits story. And we are now way over the hour mark.
Way over the hour mark. But that was a great Tom Waits story. I didn't even finish talking with Dracula, but that's
okay. Oh, I'm so sorry.
We can finish talking with Dracula in a future episode.
Yes. That will be fun. But for now, we should probably play music.
Oh yeah, let's play that music. Woo.